How would you define obedience? Suppose I were to tell my son, and let's just pick on Matthew. Suppose I were to tell my son, Matthew, collect the trash around the house, take it out to the rolling trash container outside, and then roll that container out to the street. And he says, yes, I'll do that. And then I'm up in my office later in the day, and I hear the trash truck come by, and it doesn't stop at our house. It just goes right by. And I look outside, and I see that there's no trash container out by the street. And so I find Matthew, and I say, Matthew, you didn't do what I told you to do. You disobeyed me. And he says, I didn't disobey. I said, I'll do it, and I will do it tomorrow. Did he obey? That's a fictitious story, by the way. Matthew did not do that. But in that story, did he obey? When he said, I will do it, with the intention of putting it off, was that obedience or not? Is obedience tomorrow the same as good as obedience today? Clearly, in that example, the answer is no. We're going to have to sit around with that trash for a whole week before the trash truck comes back again and picks it up. But always, the answer is no. Delayed obedience is disobedience. Last week, we focused on Jacob's conversion at Penuel. Jacob has been all concerned about his brother Esau, and he thinks that Esau is his main problem, remember? But God separates Jacob from all of his possessions, from all of his family, all that he has sought for so long. And then God wrestles with him all night. And Jacob resists him. He fights against God for hours and hours. And then God just touches his hip and disables him, ends the contest, showing that he was the one who was in control from the very beginning. And finally, with no ability to fight God any longer, Jacob does what he should have done from the very beginning. He just clings to God. He holds on to God and says, God, I will not let you go. He sees, finally, that his relationship to God has been the real problem in his life all along. The problem was not Esau. The problem was not his father-in-law, Laban, tricking him. The problem was not his father, Isaac, who preferred Esau, his older brother, to himself. The problem all along has been Jacob's relationship to God. And finally, at long last, at Penuel, he gets that right. And he clings to God. He sees God as his greatest joy. He won't let him go. And Jacob becomes, finally, a man of God. We too must cling to God in a similar way. God gives Jacob a new name to show that something has changed inside him. God calls him Israel. And as we said last time, I believe that that should be translated, God prevails, not he prevails with God. But God prevails. And Jacob walks away from this encounter with God limping, without his former physical prowess, but inwardly he is a changed man. A man who knows that clinging to God is the source of his greatest joy. Well, today we consider the next two chapters of Genesis, covering Jacob's actual meeting with Esau, which he was in such fear about earlier, and then approximately the next 10 years of his life. And in his meeting with Esau, we see new evidence of the new Jacob, of Israel, not Jacob. But then Jacob, yes, Jacob, delays his obedience to God with disastrous results for his family, and for the nations around him. What about you? Are you putting off obedience to God in some way? Let's see how God uses the life of Jacob to teach us these very important lessons. So we'll do this under three headings. First of all, the false problem, Esau. And under that, we'll see the relationship restored and Jacob's witness damaged. Second heading, obedience delayed. And third heading, tragedy, with two subheadings, a daughter raped and a city raped. So first of all, the false problem, Esau. A relationship restored. Jacob has met God, and he trusts God, but he still has no idea how Esau is going to respond. Esau is still coming with his 400 men. And so what's going to happen when Esau and his 400 men come right to Jacob? Is he going to capture a lot of the people? Is he going to fight against them? Is he going to destroy Jacob and all of his family? But before, Jacob was cowering. Now, limping, he goes out to the front, in front of all his possessions and all his family, to meet Esau and see what God is going to do in this situation. And we see this in Genesis 33, 3 and 4. He himself went before them, bowing himself to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. These two brothers haven't seen each other for 20 years. Esau certainly had a right to be angry with Jacob, didn't he? But he's not angry. Esau rejoices to see Jacob. He doesn't bring up any of the quarrels of the past. He just grabs him, hugs him, and kisses him. Esau has forgiven his brother. Jacob had worried and worried and worried about Esau, hadn't he? For 20 years, he had wondered if the next time he encountered Esau, it was going to be the last minute of his life. But now he sees, again, one more time, that Esau was not the problem. This underlines, again, Jacob's understanding of the real problem. The only really important problem had been his relationship with God. Well, then, Esau sees Jacob's large family, and he says, "Who are all these with you?" And Jacob's reply is telling, as in verse 5, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." All the children, all the wives come and bow before Esau, and Jacob acknowledges yet again that all he has comes from God's undeserved favor. Remember, Jacob had sent hordes of flocks ahead of him as gifts to Esau to appease him before Esau arrived. And Esau at first tells Jacob, "I don't need all these things. I don't want all these gifts from you." But Jacob insists, saying, "No, please, if I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand." And then he says this, "For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." Some accuse Jacob of being false in this interaction. Indeed, some people might say that he's equating Esau with God. He's just buttering him up. And he's still just trying to appease Esau. I don't think that's right. Remember what has just happened between Jacob and God. Jacob had just seen God for who he is. He held fast to God and would not let go, seeing that God's blessing is more important than everything else, even more important than than going out to see Esau when the sun had come up. He has seen the vileness and emptiness of his life prior to this point. He has seen that he lived a life of great sinfulness, a life that was an affront to God, and he had repented and looked to God for his joy and his hope. God could have killed him, and he might have anticipated that God would kill him if he was going to wrestle with God for a night. God could have punished him for his sin, but he did not. God forgave him and then bestowed on Jacob this new name. Do you see the parallel with Esau? Like God, Esau was rightly angry with Jacob. Like God, Jacob had sinned against Esau. Like God, Esau had the power to do away with Jacob. He came with 400 men. And like God, Esau forgave Jacob. And so, yes, there's a parallel there. I don't think Jacob is stretching things. He's not saying Esau is himself godlike. He's saying, my encounter with you, Esau, is very similar to this encounter I just had with God. And I feel it is such so marvelous to me to have your forgiveness, just as I just experienced God's forgiveness. So I think Jacob is speaking from his heart here when he says that seeing your face, Esau, forgiving me is like the experience I just had with God. Note, too, Jacob's true humility. He not only explicitly recognizes God as the source of all of his possessions, which Esau does not, but he also acknowledges that both God and Esau have graciously forgiven him. He doesn't argue for his rights. He doesn't rehash the old battles with Esau. He begs for forgiveness, and he receives it. And when Esau agrees to take Jacob's gift, in this culture, he could not do that if he was still withholding his forgiveness. Esau's accepting of Jacob's gift in this culture is a picture, a symbol that he has indeed forgiven Jacob and the relationship is now restored. So this encounter begins with not Jacob, but Israel, the new man here. Unfortunately, it doesn't end that way. The old Jacob pokes his head out in the next few verses. Look at verse 12. Then Esau said, "Let us journey on our way, and I will go ahead of you." But Jacob said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are frail, and the nursing flocks and herds are a care to me. If they are driven hard for one day, all the flocks will die. Let my Lord pass on ahead of his servant, and I will lead on slowly at the pace of the livestock that are ahead of me and at the pace of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir." Skip down to verse 17. Esau has left. Where does Jacob go? Does he follow Esau to Seir? But Jacob journeyed to Succoth. Esau invites Jacob to come to his house and to stay with him for a while. Jacob has no place to stay in this land. Esau has established a household in Seir, what became Edom, and he invites Jacob to come and stay with him. Jacob doesn't want to go there. In this desire, he's probably right. Esau is no longer a physical threat to Jacob and his family, but Esau's household may well be a spiritual threat to Jacob and his family. Esau has forgiven his brother, but there's no evidence that Esau's relationship with God has been restored. And as we shall see, God has other plans for Jacob than to have him live together with his brother. Furthermore, chapter 36 is going to tell us that their flocks were so huge that, like Lot and Abraham before them, they were not able to live close to each other because they would not have enough pasture for their flocks. But Jacob doesn't say any of that. Instead, what does he do? He simply lies. He lies. He tells Esau that he's going to follow after him when he has no intention of doing so. Why? Why does he lie? Fundamentally, he lies because he does not trust God. If he trusted God, then he would feel free to say whatever the truth was in a kind way and leave the outcome to God. But he doesn't trust God. He reverts to his old habit of deceit to try to make sure that everything goes according to the way he wants it to go. And so he lies because he doesn't trust God. Does it work? Seems to. At first, Esau and Jacob part on good terms, and everything seems hunky-dory. But think about it. Imagine Esau in Seir, waiting for his brother to arrive. He waits a week, a month, a few months, still no Jacob. And then he learns, oh, Jacob built a house at Succoth and is living there. What is Esau going to think? Same old Jacob, still lying to me, still deceiving me. The relationship between Jacob and Esau has been restored, but Jacob has just learned the night before that the most important relationship is the relationship between him and God. What about the relationship between Esau and God? Didn't Jacob have an opportunity to display that he's a changed person and to explain why he's a changed person and to give to Esau the opportunity to come before God and repent and change? Couldn't Jacob, of all people, coming to Esau humbly, seeking his forgiveness, have followed that up by being an effective witness to his brother of the need to restore his relationship with God? But by lying to him, he took that opportunity and he just blew it. So that Esau no longer will look to Jacob with that same sense that he did after Jacob came seeking forgiveness. Now, once again, he sees him just as this brother of mine who always lies. I can't trust him. I can't believe a word he says to me. What about you? Have you received God's forgiveness? Have you discovered that God is the source of your greatest joy? Are your actions and words and attitudes destroying your ability to witness to some of those who are closest to you? That's the false problem. The false problem, Esau. Now, obedience delayed. Look at verses 17 to 20. But Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. And Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, on his way from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. And from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. There he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Question. Jacob's been away for 20 years. What should he do when he returns to Canaan? Think of it this way. If you went out of the United States for 20 years, when you came back to the country, what would be some of the first things you would do? Certainly, you would go and see your parents shortly thereafter. Evidently, Rebekah is dead by now. We don't have that recorded in Scripture, but it seems that she is dead. But Isaac is alive. And Jacob does not return to his father. He does not go back and introduce his grandchildren, Isaac's grandchildren, to him. He doesn't go back and ask forgiveness from Isaac for deceiving him. He doesn't go back and thank Isaac for sending him away with no money, because that was so central to Jacob's conversion, being sent out without the resources he had depended on in the past. Indeed, remember, when Jacob left initially, he went to Bethel. God appeared to him at Bethel, the stairway going up and down to heaven. And remember what Jacob says to him? One of the things that he says is that if you, God, will lead me so that I come again to my father's house in peace. And then he makes some promises that we're going to look at later. But when he leaves, he says, I want to go back to my father's house in peace. Now he's back in Canaan. Where does he go? He doesn't go to Isaac. God has fulfilled the condition. Jacob can go back to his house in peace, but he doesn't. And he doesn't just wait a week or a month or a few months. He waits 10 years to go see his father. So it's 30 years from the time he last sees his father to the time he sees him again. Why? We can see some answers just on a human level. His mother's dead. His father always loved Esau more than he loved Jacob. There clearly was tension between Jacob and Isaac. He had deceived Isaac, and so he doesn't know how he will be received when he goes back. Isaac blessed him, but then sent him away with nothing, and although that was for his good, it must have been very painful, and maybe there's still some anger there because of that. So we can understand how Jacob might feel in this circumstance. But the root of Jacob's failure to go see his father is the sin of failing to trust God. Jacob had been afraid of Esau, but he was forced into meeting him. But then there were forgiveness and tears of joy from Esau. Jacob seems to be afraid of Isaac, and he's not forced to meet him, and so he procrastinates and delays. And even though there will be forgiveness and tears of joy when he sees him, he doesn't know that for sure, and so he doesn't go back. That's a big failure on Jacob's part. But there's an even more important visit that Jacob fails to make. Now I want to go back to chapter 28 and read what Jacob says to God. 28 verses 20 to 22. God has just spoken to him, promising him that he is going to be with him, that he is his God. And at Bethel, Jacob says this: if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. Now, we talked about that and said this is not the way that Jacob should have responded to God, this attempt to bargain with him. But nevertheless, this is an important encounter between Jacob and God, and he says this to him. Later, when Jacob is still living with Laban, God appears to him and he introduces himself in chapter 31, verse 13, as saying, I am the God of Bethel. I am the God you met at Bethel. Shouldn't Jacob return to Bethel? Shouldn't Jacob fulfill his promise that this stone shall be God's house? Shouldn't, upon his return to Canaan, Jacob go initially to Bethel and then to his father? After the tragic events of chapter 34, God explicitly tells Jacob in chapter 35, verse 1, go to Bethel. As far as we know, God had not given Jacob an explicit command prior to that point, but I think it's obvious that he should have gone, that he was under obligation to go to Bethel. And he did not go because he did not trust God. instead of obeying joyfully and going to Bethel and then to his father, Jacob goes first to Succoth, where he builds a house, and then to the Canaanite city of Shechem, where he buys land. And we can calculate, particularly from Joseph's age and from Dinah's age, that he stays in these places at least 10 years. Why didn't Jacob go to Bethel? You know, I picture Jacob in Succoth with the intention of going to Bethel. I think he had it in his mind. Maybe he didn't intend to spend any time there, really. He only intended to rest a little bit after his encounters with Laban and Esau and his wrestling with God all night and his being disabled in the hip. Maybe he even justified his staying there by saying, I need to prepare myself spiritually before I encounter God at Bethel. Or maybe he just liked the convenience of living near the town of Shechem instead of living out in tents like Abraham and Isaac had done. But day passes on today, and still Jacob does not leave Shechem. He stays there 10 years. And then it takes a dual family tragedy to force him to leave. Now note this carefully. The sordid events recorded in chapter 34 are a direct result of Jacob's delayed obedience. If Jacob had obeyed God, gone to Bethel, gone to his father, these events in chapter 34 would never have taken place. I'm sure Jacob thought, oh yes, you know, I need to go to Bethel, and I need to go see my father, but this is kind of an inconvenient time. I'll go tomorrow. And tomorrows come and go one by one, and always Jacob intends to obey God in a few more days. And those few days become years, and finally his family faces a tragedy. Delayed obedience is disobedience. What obedience are you delaying? What do you know you should do that you put off and you put off and you put off? Tragedy. A daughter raped. Jacob lives right outside of Shechem. His father and grandfather knew well that they were not to intermarry with the Canaanites. And they kept themselves separate from the Canaanites. Indeed, Isaac had explicitly told Jacob 20 years before, you must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. And clearly, Jacob knew that should apply to his sons as well. So what's he doing living right before the city of Shechem? Jacob knows that separation from the Canaanites is an important part of his fulfilling the promise to Abraham. And Jacob wanted to be the heir of that promise to Abraham so badly. And yet he's jeopardizing the whole thing by the place that he's living. Jacob, with sons and daughters now of marriageable age, takes no precautions. He shouldn't have lived where he did. And given that he was living there, he should have supervised and limited any encounters between his children and the children of the city. But he doesn't. Chapter 34, verses 1 and 2. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. Dinah is 15 or 16 years old at this point. And she goes out, presumably looking for friends among the Canaanite women and girls. And the prince of the area sees her and rapes her violently. And if we look ahead to verse 26, we can see that he also keeps her locked up in his house. He does not allow her to return to her family. How does Jacob react to this? Verse 5. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah But his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. Excuse me? He didn't send someone to his sons to tell them something tragic has happened, come here, we need to take counsel together and figure out what we're going to do. His sons are now 16 to 23 years old. So they are young men. But Jacob seems to be so used to delaying that he just waits for his sons to come home. He shows no leadership. He shows no concern for his daughter still in the household of this Canaanite prince. Well, his sons have a quite different reaction. Verse 7, the sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they heard of it. They evidently didn't hear about it from their father. And the men were indignant and very angry because Shechem had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. At least the narrator lets us know that the son's reaction here is better than Jacob's reaction. Unlike their father, Jacob's sons realize that Shechem has committed a terrible crime, and they're angry. Their father needs to recognize that evil, but then he needs to channel that anger into a productive course. He needs to lead his family in seeking God's face concerning how to get Dinah back and how to respond to the tragedy. But Jacob does none of this. Shechem and his father, the king, Hamor, come proposing marriage. And they promise to pay any bride price that Jacob might name. And furthermore, seeing the many young, eligible young men in this family, they propose that these young men marry daughters of the people from Shechem, and that Jacob make this his permanent home, and that he become one people with them. This is obviously impossible for Jacob if he's going to fulfill God's promise. But Jacob makes no reply. He doesn't say anything. And with their father not saying anything, Jacob's sons take the lead. And they choose to follow old Jacob and not new Israel. They choose to speak deceitfully to the people of the land. So they promise them that Dinah can be Shechem's wife, and they promise them that they indeed will intermarry with the daughters of the city if all the males in the city agree to undergo circumcision. In using circumcision deceitfully here, what are they doing? They're taking the sign of the covenant between God and Abraham and using it as a tool to accomplish a horrible purpose. They, in effect, are despising their birthright as effectively as Esau despised his birthright when he sold it to Jacob for a pot of little stew. But the deceit works in the sense that Shechem and Hamor agree. And then Shechem and Hamor go out, and they have the difficult task of convincing hundreds of adult men to undergo a painful procedure. But they succeed in doing that by saying, look at all these livestock that these men have, and effectively these livestock will be ours if they become one people with us. They're going to give us this livestock in part as a bride price for the wives that we will get, that we will give to them. But then they will become one people with us, so all these things effectively will indeed belong to us. And so all the men agree to be circumcised, and this effectively disables these men for several days. Verse 25. On the third day when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field, all their wealth, all their little ones, and their wives, all that was in the houses, they captured and plundered. They raped the city. The man Shechem rapes Dinah, and Levi and Simeon raped the city Shechem. Simeon and Levi were right to be angry. They were right to recognize that Shechem had done something terrible. But as is so often the case, in revenge, they commit an even greater evil than the evil that prompted their anger. How does Jacob react? Verse 30. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" What's astounding in this whole encounter between Jacob and his sons, this whole account, is there is not one mention of God. And Jacob, when he looks at this, doesn't say anything about how wrong what Simeon and Levi did was. All he says is, "What's going to be the impact on me? I'm in danger now because of what you've done." And Simeon and Levi, though wrong in their actions, are right in their response to their father. Shechem committed a grave sin, and there's no evidence that Jacob was going to do anything about it. He left the initiative to his sons, and then they fall prey to the temptation to take revenge. So Jacob's delayed obedience puts him in this terrible situation. And once the rape occurs, Jacob's failure to trust God, his failure to lead his family in seeking God's face, to know how to respond, leads to an even greater tragedy. And furthermore, Jacob's sons, while they have not intermarried, are taking on the attitudes and actions of the Canaanites around them. They're living like the Canaanites in taking revenge. And we'll see in the next several chapters that these sons of Jacob indeed take on other characteristics of the Canaanites. So Jacob's delayed obedience is disobedience, and his family suffers tremendously as a result. Well, as we have seen, Jacob delays his obedience to God because of a failure to trust God's power and a failure to trust God's love. If he had had confidence that God was in control, he would gladly have obeyed and gone to Bethel and gone to see his father. Even though, in human terms, we must acknowledge there were risks involved in going to see his father. So there are two key lessons for us that we must remember from this sordid story. Obey God promptly. Don't say, "Oh, I'll begin obeying God tomorrow, or next week, or next month, or at the new year." When obedience seems risky, secondly, trust God. Know that He is in control. He loves you with a love that's beyond measure. And He will guard what He has entrusted to you until the final day. Know that obedience to Him is joy. Is fulfilling the purpose of your creation. Not an onerous path that you go through to try to earn God's favor. But obedience to God is becoming what He wants you to be, as we read in Deuteronomy. The commandments which God has given you, for what purpose? For your good. Deuteronomy 10:13. So obey right away. Trust always. Sounds simple, doesn't it? How do you need to apply these lessons? How do you need to depend on Jesus Christ and nothing else? Are you failing to obey God by not dealing with explicit sin in your life? Are you failing to admit these sins to others? Do you keep putting off the seeking out of someone else to help you and stand beside you and hold you accountable? Are you failing to deal with anger in your life, or bitterness, or lust and pornography? Are you failing to deal with pride in your life? Or is your sin a sin of omission, as it was for Jacob? Are you putting off doing something that you know you should do? Going and seeking forgiveness from someone whom you wronged? Or leading your family in consistent devotions. Or having a discussion about spiritual things with a member of your family, or a colleague, or a coworker, or a neighbor. Or witnessing to that unlovable person who's in your life. Or helping the poor, or being involved with missions. What are you not pursuing now? What obedience are you delaying? One of Satan's most effective lies is you can put that off till tomorrow. Don't have to do that today. Don't fulfill that promise right now. But tomorrow will be just as good. So just wait. Just wait. Have you heard Satan say that to you? Don't fall prey to that. Delayed obedience is disobedience. Obey God now to your joy. Jesus did not delay his obedience in going to the cross, did he? And by that obedience, in dying on the cross at the right time, in the right place, Jesus provides forgiveness and restored relationships with God for all who believe. Jesus obeyed promptly and trusted God in the midst of obedience that took him through terrible suffering. And as the author of the book of Hebrews tells us, he is the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. He blazed the way for us of joyful obedience to God. And he's the one who will perfect our faith, who will complete our faith, who will give us the faith we need to obey promptly and trust God in the midst of whatever trials may come about because of that obedience. So your obedience, too, may lead to suffering. But Paul tells us, be strengthened by the grace that is in Christ Jesus. Suffer hardship with me like a good soldier of Christ Jesus. Remember Jesus Christ. He says, I endure everything for the sake of the elect, that they also may obtain the salvation that is in Christ Jesus with eternal glory. And he says, if we endure, what? We shall also reign with him. That's your calling. That's your calling. That's the purpose for which God created you. To live a life of joyful obedience. Obedience that comes from faith, knowing that God is worthy of our trust and putting our hope in him, and then stepping out in faith, in obedience, knowing that God will use that to accomplish his purposes in our lives, even if it leads to pain, even if it leads to our death, that he will use that for his glory. So obey promptly, trust God, and know that your greatest joy will come in that obedience and trust.